Welcome to Are You Quizzing Me? I am Vineet Nair with my co-host Aditya Kashyap. This is a quizzing trivia podcast show. Join us as we dive deep into history, science, pop culture, and so much more. Let's get quizzing. And we're back for episode number 65 of Are You Quizzing Me? Your favorite quizzing and trivia podcast show. If you hadn't joined us last week, for those who came in late, as Lee Falk used to say, we have a special guest today who had also come last week. Rajiv De Silva will be joining us this week again as guest quizmaster. If you've missed last week's episode, go back and listen to that and then come back because we've introduced Rajiv there. So I'll be giving just a short introduction again. If you want to know exactly what he does, go back to episode number 64 and you'll get a proper introduction to the man that is Rajiv De Silva. So let's start off today's proceedings with our regular programming. So we'll start off with a question for our audience. So this is the audience question for today, which I will be answering at the end of today's episode. So in 2012, Prada, you know, the fashion brand Prada, had a fall show featuring a diabolical collection of East German-inspired fashion. Many consider the show to be one of the greatest that Prada has ever staged, with some very big names strutting down the catwalk wearing Prada clothes. What was the theme and who were these big name models? I will answer this at the end of today's episode. We have Aditya's not so serious question from last week, which I am frankly dying to know what the answer is. So Aditya, what was your question from last week?
So the question from last week requires the audience member to go listen to last week's episode. And here's why. Because the question was about if instead of a pigeon fulfilling a certain challenge to prove that internet speeds were very slow in Durban in South Africa, a crow had been used for the same thing, what would one say at the end of that challenge? And here's why you have to listen to the episode. Because the answer references last week's episode. And that is, well, crow...
Oh, God. No. No. Kill me now. Kill me now.
Okay.
Now is a good time as any to introduce our audience again. Once again to Rajiv De Silva, architect, quizzer, and birder extraordinaire, and our guest quizmaster for the second episode running. Rajiv, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back. I had great fun. I didn't know what to expect in last week's episode because, as I said, it was my first time. But I had a lot of time, a lot of fun, and hopefully more fun will be had today.
Yes, we shall. And again, as our guest, you get to go first. So, Rajiv, suck us with one of your questions.
Okay, great. So, last time, I started off with a sports question. You didn't know it was a sports question till a little deep into the question, but this time I'll tell you straight out, it is a out-and-out sports question. So, and this is from the world of tennis. Okay, since its inception in 1900, the Davis Cup, which, as you know, is like a competition played between countries rather than the other competitions that happen on the tennis circuit, which is between individuals. So the Davis Cup has been played annually without break, except for the 9 years that covered the two world wars. And since this question is a little dated, it possibly had a break during COVID also, but irrelevant to the question as of now. But until South Africa won it in 1974, the previous 66 titles had been split between just four nations. So 66 editions had been won by four nations until South Africa became the first one from outside that four. To win it in 1974. So, which are the four nations that had won it before 1974?
I have a feeling this is similar to one of our other quizmasters and quizzers in Goa, Dr. Chandrasekhar. Shout out to him. He has what I call upsource questions, where there is a very obvious answer which turns out not to be the answer. So, but I'm going to track myself into that trap anyway. I'm going to guess the first one is England.
Okay,
so you're thinking of the UK or England. Is that the reason you kind of
Yeah. No, I was only wondering whether I should give it to you for just one country or wait for all four countries.
No, okay. No, you know, you'll have to take pity on us. We're not going to give you all four countries at one time. We'll get one right, you know, in order and sequence.
Okay, so then I will tell you that Britain or UK or England is correct indeed. So what are the other three?
Second on my guest list, get it, is the US.
And that would also be right.
Okay. Aditya, why don't you take the next two?
Oh, wow. Very convenient. Low-hanging fruits of Vineet. Okay. Just because, I guess, Russia in
no,
general...
No, in fact, Russia isn't part of that group.
Okay. Yeah, okay. It's the usual suspects, I guess, are probably not the right answer because Vineet got the ones that were. So, because I would have gone with something like China or yeah, I can't actually think of many.
Okay. So let me give you an additional clue. So the US and the UK or Britain, whatever, is obviously correct. But these aren't four random countries, right? Okay. There's a reason why it is the four countries. Or you can figure out, if you know a little bit about tennis, which four countries it would be.
Oh, is it France and is it Australia?
That is correct. When done, it is the UK, the US, the four Grand Slams. The reason that the four Grand Slams are called the Grand Slams are because these four countries were so dominant in the world of tennis at that.
Ooh.
You know, for a long period of time. And it became that the big tournaments in those countries became like the four big tournaments. And those four are the Grand Slams.
I absolutely did not know that.
That is insane. And it's a question I should have asked myself. I love trivia. I don't know why I never asked myself, why are these the four Grand Slams? That's brilliant.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Wow.
Well, thank you. So that's what it is, yes.
Cracker of a question. I really like that. Aditya, why don't you start us off with your question for our round?
All right, okay. So since we were traveling the globe, let's go to Korea for my question. Mm-hmm. And in this case, I'm going to tell you a little bit about personality types in Korea. So if you were maybe a Korean young individual, you're out there and you're talking about dating and somebody asks you, what's your personality type? You might say you are the farmer or you are the hunter or you're the humanist or perhaps the warrior. What are these personality types based on?
Okay, I have a guess, but I want to know. I'm not going to guess it right now. I'm going to give Rajiv the chance. But I want to know, I'm going to ask one question which will let me know whether I'm on the right track or not. Are there four of those?
You are absolutely right. I mentioned the four and there are only four of these. Yes.
Okay, yes.
Okay, so which were the four? The farmer, the hunter, the humanist, and the?
Warrior.
The warrior. Well, just going by the number, I'm going to make some weird guess. Well, there are these four symbols on the South Korean flag. And do each of the symbols stand for one of these people or personality types or something mythological, I guess. And then everybody is supposed to be one of those.
That is actually a lovely piece of trivia regarding the South Korean flag and what those four symbols are, which I will talk about at the end of this question. So, brilliant guess, given that you didn't have context to it. But no, it's not the right answer.
Okay. Well, no. Then I can't think of anything else. My other obvious thing would be, but it can't be zodiac symbols because there are 12 of them. South Korea. No. I think I'm going to have to pass this one to Vineet. Clearly has a better guess. He's sitting with a very smug expression.
Okay, this is not smug. Let me clarify. This is not smug.
We have an unbiased third person opinion now.
No. I have a fairly good guess, which I think may be right, and which I think is right because Korea is a weird country. No offense, Koreans. Are these personalities based on blood group?
These are blood group personality types. Yes, these are blood group personality types.
Okay, nice. Of course, yeah. Of course.
So in Korea, okay, if you are out on a date or you're meeting a new person and you want to figure out what their personality is like, you might ask them what their blood group is. And if you're a blood type A, you're a farmer. The traits associated with them are patient, punctual, which are the positive ones, and worst traits would be secretive and closed off. Then blood type B is the hunter. The traits, the good ones would be animal loving, creative, flexible. The worst are impatient, forgetful, irresponsible. We have the humanist, which is AB. And there you have cool and rational and empathetic, but also aloof, critical and indecisive. And the last one is type O, which is a warrior, where you have athletic, robust, ambitious, but sometimes insensitive, vain and arrogant. So these are the personality types associated with blood groups in Korea.
Sounds like a lot of work, frankly. Just talk to the person.
But sometimes you just need a shorthand for knowing how a person... I've been on the receiving end of this. I am a Scorpio myself, and I have had conversations go derail very quickly when people find out I'm a Scorpio. I don't even know why. Like, I don't know how I'm responsible for that.
Frankly, you tell me you're a Scorpio, all that tells me is that you know when your birthday is and it matches to some symbol in the zodiac. That's it. I have no clue why people... I've had conversations similarly where I'd say that I'm an Aquarius, and then you're like, oh, yeah, but you don't look like an Aquarian.
The case that in South Africa, that wouldn't make sense if you talked about blood groups, but it is what it is.
South Korea, yeah. Okay, nice one. Ah, yes, the flag.
Ah, why didn't you tell us the funda about the flag?
Yeah, the flag thing is going to be a question in one of the future episodes, but since you brought it up, I'm just going to say it now. It's actually something called a trigram. And I won't pronounce the names in Korean, obviously, because I won't be able to do that. But they are all different. And from a quick glance, it might look like they're all four the same, but they're all different. There is a dash in between and a space in between some of those lines. If you check out the Korean flag, I'd encourage you to open it up right now. And all of those Korean trigrams have a certain feature attached to it. So the first one is heaven. The second one is Earth, the third one is Sun, and the last one is Moon. And they also have, you know, parallels with air, earth, fire, water, some sort of social fabric.
And when they all come together, they become Captain Planet?
Captain Planet. Yes. So, the trigrams and the flag of South Korea do have that meaning. So, if you didn't know, now you know. Also, speaking of horoscopes... I have to say, the most ridiculous thing, and since you mentioned it, I'm going to say it, the most ridiculous thing is that Aquarius is not a water type sign, it's an air type sign, which makes zero sense to me. How can Aquarius not be water type?
Oh, is it not?
It's literally a water carrier.
Well,
not that any of it makes any sense, but why is Aquarius not a water sign, it's an air sign? It makes no sense at all. But that happens to be the case, yes.
Yeah.
Rajiv.
Okay.
Lovely.
So, my question. So the funny thing is I had a list of questions that I thought I'd ask on this podcast. And just while we were discussing something, I remembered another question, which is not on my list. But it's possibly it's a very nice question, possibly one of my favorite questions. And so also, it may be a bit of a chestnut and maybe well-known, but I think it's still worth asking. So, you know, back in the 2000s, or at least they had a good run for many years, there was this satellite phone company called Iridium. They unfortunately went bust because I think after some time, either satellite phones were too expensive or kind of irrelevant because mobile phone coverage got so much better. But as you may know, the Iridium was a satellite phone, and you could have an Iridium phone pretty much anywhere in the world and be able to call anybody up and stuff like that. So it made where you were irrelevant. So Iridium, before they went belly up, had a very beautiful tagline with which they promoted their service, right? And it was a three-word tagline, three words, two of which are basically high school subjects. So, what was the three-word tagline of Iridium, which very beautifully put what the phone was doing? So, three words, two words are high school subjects or school subjects.
Oh, geography is history.
That is right. Well, yes. The slogan was geography is history, because it suddenly made geography irrelevant. And, you know,
nice.
So well worked out. I could see the light bulb moment actually was seen there.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Great question. I love that you could work it out. When you said, I was like, okay, I remember the Iridium platform. They were talking about 40, 60 satellites circling the Earth, and you can get reception anywhere. And that was the time, early 2000s, when satellite radio was also becoming a thing.
Yeah.
So this whole thing of, you know, shifting everything to satellites was a huge thing. And I remember the Iridium platform. I couldn't remember what their logo, what their tagline was. And then when you mentioned high school subjects, I was like, okay, what are the high school subjects? Civics, economics, geography.
Yeah. Okay, good
great question.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to ask now a very long question. Okay, so I need both of you to pay very close attention, and our audience, you may get lost in between, but I will give you precis in between to catch you up. So pay very close attention. This is a three-part question with a follow-up to it. Okay, so it's very indulgent. Please indulge my whimsy in this. And it's architecture related, so.
Oh, okay.
Different forms of X have been seen in ancient Egyptian architecture, on Greek temples, and most famously on medieval buildings. The etymology of the word X is from a French word, which in English is likely to mean throat or gullet. Okay, so I'll just go through that again so that you have X fixed in your mind. Different types of X have been seen in ancient Egypt, on Greek temples, and most famously on medieval buildings. The etymology or the origin of the word X is from a French word, which when translated to English likely means throat or gullet. Okay, that is X. Y is an architectural feature named after a mythical Greek creature, which is quite apt considering the creature after which it is named. Okay, so Y is an architectural feature named after a mythical Greek creature from Greek mythology. And the naming is quite apt considering the creature after which it is named. Now, I've told you about X and Y. In the Middle Ages, the term Babywin was used to refer to both X and Y. And the word Babywin was derived from the Italian word babuino, which means baboon. Okay, so in the Middle Ages, the word babuin, which was from the Italian babuino, which means baboon, was used to refer to both X and Y. Today, however, both X and Y are known by the term Z, which is known to the common man as an adjective describing something which is comically or repulsively ugly or distorted. Okay, the old terminology which was used to describe X and Y was babuin, which is from the Italian word for baboon. Today, the word that we use to describe X and Y, that term Z, is known to the common man as an adjective describing something which is comically repulsive, ugly, or distorted. So can you identify X, Y, and Z? X and Y are both architectural features. Z is a term today that is used to commonly describe these two architectural features.
Hey.
I know the answer to this.
Oh, okay.
So,
Aditya, retire to the pavilion.
Yes.
Well, I can take a guess at one of them.
Okay.
But it's very likely that the answer I give for one will turn out to be the answer for another.
That's not a problem. I will accept the answer if it's any one of these three.
I mean, there's got to be the word gargoyle somewhere. And I would say that is X.
Very good. X is gargoyle.
Okay, that's good. So then you said Y is also another term for gargoyle, right?
No, it's an architectural feature. It's a different from a gargoyle, but it's an architectural feature named after a mythical Greek creature.
Ah, okay.
And the term Z is today encompasses both gargoyles and this feature Y. So you could technically say that gargoyle is a type of Z and Y is also a type of Z.
Okay, and also Z is used to describe an ugly person or something.
Yeah, so Z, like if you told the term Z to a common person, they wouldn't think of an architectural feature. They would think of an adjective describing something which is comically or repulsively ugly or distorted.
Oh, okay.
Or if they are a, how do I put this? If they are a typographer, they may think of a font or a type of font or a group of font.
Okay. So then I would say that Z is grotesque.
Okay.
Well, yes or no?
Yes, Z is grotesque. So then what is Y?
Y, you said, is an architectural feature, which is, what does it do?
Named after a mythical Greek creature. And it's very apt considering the creature after which it is named. Do you want a clue on Y?
Yes, I think so.
So Y was famously slain in Greek mythology by Bellerophon.
Oh, yeah.
Bellerophon riding Pegasus.
I'm thinking Chimera, but I don't think there's any architectural feature like Chimera, right?
It is Chimera.
Oh, it is Chimera?
It is Chimera.
But what's the architectural feature which is a Chimera?
Yes, so I'll come to that. So I will now explain everything in detail for our audience, many of whom may be wondering what the hell is going on. So, as I mentioned, in architecture, a grotesque is a fantastic or mythical figure carved from stone and fixed to the walls or roof of a building. Okay? Many scholars describe grotesques as being used to ward off evil and as reminders of separation between earth and the divine. So it's usually found on buildings of religious significances, churches, cathedrals, and so on. Gargoyles are specific types of grotesques which are made specifically for the function of conveying water from the roof and away from the side of a building. So basically, they are very fancy water spouts. So you can only call it a gargoyle if it has the function of
having water.
Yes, exactly. A chimera, however, is a type of grotesque depicting a mythical combination of multiple animals, sometimes including humans. Hence, the term chimera. And for those who did not know, a chimera was a monstrous fire-breathing hybrid creature from Lycia in Greek mythology. It's depicted as a lion with the head of the goat protruding from its back, occasionally animal parts, and with dragon's wings and a tail that may end with a snake's head. It was an offspring of the titan Typhon and Echidna, and a sibling of monsters such as Cerberus and the Lenaean Hydra. So because the name is from a hodgepodge, from a creature made from a hodgepodge of other animals, this particular type of grotesque, which is a combination of multiple animals, is also called a chimera. Interesting fact about gargoyles, they have found gargoyle-like features at Göbekli Tepe, which is a Neolithic site in southeastern Turkey, dating back as far as 9500 BCE.
Nice.
So, this was the main question. Now everybody knows what a grotesque is, what a gargoyle is, and what a chimera is, right? So this is the follow-up to this main question. In the 1980s, Aditya, you can come back to bat on the pitch, by the way. You're back from the pavilion. In the 1980s, during the construction of the Northwest Tower of the Washington National Cathedral, a children's competition was run by National Geographic World to draw grotesques for the building. The winning entries were a raccoon, a girl with pigtails and braces, a man with large teeth and an umbrella, and a pop culture icon of evil. Which pop culture icon ended up as a grotesque on the Northwest Tower of the Washington National Cathedral?
Okay, I actually know this one, so I'm going to give it to Aditya.
Okay, Aditya.
Oh. Perfect, because I have no clue. you said pop culture icon, right? Of evil.
Yes.
And this is in the 80s.
This is the 1980s.
And it's given to kids, so I'm assuming it's either a fairy tale villain, or we're talking about a comic book villain. And because comic book villains are a lot more fun, so I'm just going to go with something like the Joker.
No, good guess. No, I would say that this icon, particular pop culture icon, has appeared in comics but not primarily in comics.
Interesting. So are we talking fairy tales then?
No.
Okay. So is it like ancient mythology, but has also appeared in comic books, something like that.
You could possibly call it modern mythology, given the kind of status it has.
Okay. No, I'll need a clue. I'm not, no clue at all right now.
Okay. This is going to be an audio clue. Let me just warm up the pipes.
Very cool, very cool. That obviously is... okay, I'm not going to fool around. That is Darth Vader, yeah.
Yeah, it is the Imperial March. By the way, if nobody understood from my horrible rendition, that is the Imperial March from Star Wars. And it is indeed Darth Vader. So you can find Darth Vader on the side of a church. If you think that was bad, I have another example. During the restoration of the Chapel of Bethlehem in Saint Jean de Boisseau in the early 90s, sculptor Jean-Louis Boistiel decided to replace the building's crumbling gargoyles with a few pop culture icons. This included Gizmo, a gremlin from the movie Gremlins, an alien xenomorph, and a robot from the popular anime UFO Robot Grandizer. Many locals were put off by Boistiel's creations, which are technically grotesques, but enough young movie fans got behind the geek chapel idea to get it approved. So you can go to Saint Jean de Boisseau and see an alien, a xenomorph, as a grotesque.
Yeah.
No. Nice, nice.
And modern, whatever, the internet being what it is, I think I've come across enough pieces of or articles on the internet where somebody's gone and seen Darth Vader and said that, you know, that in the 15th century or 16th century something, somebody actually foreshadowed Darth Vader and they carved it back there and stuff. They forget about the history that was done in the 80s and they think, okay, this was done in the 1700s and stuff like that. There's, if you just Google, you'll find lots of misinformation about that particular one. Okay, which is a nice segue into my next question. Because we are talking about things carved in the United States, so my next question is kind of to do with that. So, if you're a little bit familiar with the U.S. and religion and politics and the whole thing, which is all mixed up there currently, and has always been around the U.S., literally dotted across the country, are hundreds of these things called the Ten Commandments monuments. I don't know if you've heard of them or seen of them. They're basically big slabs of rock. Into which the Ten Commandments are carved, right? And there's an ongoing tussle between the secular people and religious people. Obviously, the religious people want to preserve those monuments and give them great importance in their lives and in governance and stuff like that. And whereas the secular and the atheists say, no, they should be torn down, and there's too many of these Ten Commandments monuments dotting the countryside and stuff like that. And it's a matter of I think, legal cases in several states in the U.S. And like many things, most people in the U.S. think that these Ten Commandments monuments have been around since the days of the founding fathers to remind people how, you know, that the whole American, whatever, constitution, whatever else, is based on very much the Bible and religion and stuff like that. And what many people don't know is that they were actually all erected in a short period of time, all these hundreds, in 1955, 1956, with funding from one man. For what specific purpose?
Oh, I have a 50-50 guess on this. But I'm not sure if that's the right direction. I don't know if the year is right. Funding from one man, you said?
Yes. One man funded all these monuments for a specific purpose, which had less to do with religion and all, and more to do with, you know, his own commercial interests. Let's put it that way.
I was going to guess it has something to do with movie promotion. Is there a...
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
That was...
Yeah, you guys are
time.
Thinking along the right line. So what's a more specific answer to that?
So the Ten Commandments, there was a movie called The Ten Commandments. I think it was Charlton Heston. I don't remember who played Moses. I think it was Charlton Heston.
It was Charlton Heston in Ten Commandments. Yes, so the producer of the movie, Cecil B. DeMille, a well-known producer, in order to promote the movie, he got some people to carve these around the country and then release the movie. It was basically it was just to promote the movie, but they remake way past the movie's release and screening, and they're still around. Yeah, so good answer, guys. You guys kind of worked it out together.
Nice. I find people sometimes surprised that America is so religious, right? I mean, like, America is the bastion of female liberation and rock and roll and all of those things. And they're very surprised that there are so many conservative people. And I have to keep reminding them that America was founded by Puritans. People literally too religious for the UK to... They were like, okay, go somewhere else and do your shit. So they went and founded an entire country. And you're surprised that they are religious? Like, on their currency, it's written, "In God We Trust."
In God We Trust.
Oh, so America is literally the antithesis of Australia.
Yeah.
That people were too good for the UK were sent to the US, and who were too terrible were sent to Australia.
There.
Yeah. Aditya, come on. Hit us.
So, my question has to do with a school. And a specific degree that the school offers. So I'm not mentioning the name of the school. I'm not mentioning who the founder of the school is. And I'm not telling you what the degree is also specifically. But I'll tell you a little bit of what they teach and how it is taught also. So it is usually over a weekend. It's a weekend seminar of sorts. It isn't on regular intervals. It can be at any period of time. The number of participants are apparently limited to 65. And from whatever information I could find online, I think the last run or the last batch was in 2016. So it's been a while. One of the things that is very important that you have to learn in this particular degree is forging land use permits and lock picking. Any guesses as to what this... school is, I'll take any of these answers. You can give me who the founder is, which I think would be the toughest to arrive at. But the founder, or what type of school it is, or what type of degree are they offering? The type of school and type of degree is pretty similar.
Forging land use records.
Land use and permits and
land
picking
use
locks.
Permit. Oh, okay. That's interesting.
2016, you said, na? The moment you said land use permits... my mind went to Trump, but then I was like, he wouldn't owe anything. That he's a real estate mogul. He would just steal somebody else's money. He wouldn't have to forge papers. So it's not Trump or anything. Isn't
that
lock guy...
picking would be more in Richard Nixon's light somehow.
Yeah. The Watergate Hotel. Okay, my second... Okay, yeah, I don't remember this exact name, but there was this performer who used to give classes and performances on attention spans and picking pockets. His name was Apollo something.
Whatever you're thinking is not the answer. That's my first clue. Whichever lane you're going down right now is not the answer.
Okay.
I can give you further clues. Yeah. I was just hoping, I was wondering if you might have an answer right off the bat. But if you don't, I'll help you out.
No.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit about the founder first. That's my first hint. There is an urban legend which was confirmed by him, actually. So I found this on a podcast recently, and I'll recommend that podcast at the end of this question. He confirmed this urban legend, which stated that at the beginning of his career that he's most famous for and that this school teaches, he started with a little bit of a theft. It's in the gray area whether it was stealing or not, but yeah, it was, well, let's call a spade, and it was stealing. He stole something at the beginning of his career, and that set him down a very legendary path.
That could describe half the billionaires and entrepreneurs who are in the top business.
Yeah,
right now.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
He stole one object. He stole one specific object.
Oh, this was a physical object.
Yes, it was a physical object he stole.
Okay, so it's not Mark Zuckerberg in Facebook.
No, that was literal. No. That was stealing intellectual property and shares.
Yeah.
We are absolutely going to get our podcast shut down this week for sure.
Yeah,
somebody's going to fire notice, legal notice.
Meta.
Meta, we love you.
We stole something, lock picking and
land use permits. It's a very specific thing to teach. Is this McDonald's University?
No.
No.
This, did you say this is a US thing or you didn't say that?
Actually, even the location is not determined. It might happen anywhere and at any point of time.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
Okay.
It's a weekend seminar, so it doesn't necessarily need a location.
Is this Jordan Belfort? The Wolf of Wall Street?
No.
Okay. No, I think...
Further clues are required. Okay.
Further clues are required.
All right. Yeah. It's a tough question. It's very specific. But you've obviously heard of this person. And the rest of it would follow very simply from there. So let me tell you a little bit about the school. And I'm on the school's website right now, so I'm just going to read from it. The Dash School is not for the faint-hearted. It is for those who have traveled on foot, who have worked as bouncers in sex clubs or as wardens in a lunatic asylum, for those who are willing to learn about lockpicking or forging permits in countries not favoring their projects. In short, for those who have a sense of poetry, for those who are pilgrims, for those who can tell a story to a four-year-old to 4-year-old children and hold their attention, for those who have a fire burning within, for those who have a dream.
What?
This sounds like the invitation to a cult.
So let me break that down a little bit for you. A bunch of the description in the earlier part of it about traveling on foot, working as bouncers and all of that has to do with the specific person himself. He has done all of those things in his career, but that's obviously not what he's famous for. He's known for this one thing. And
off the top of my head, when you say somebody who's done a lot of this kind of shit, especially as a bouncer, I know he's worked as a bouncer is Justin Trudeau, but I don't know why he would be having a weekend school.
No, it's not Justin Trudeau. It's a German guy.
It's a German guy.
Is he German? He is German?
All right, one last clue. Okay. So what all of us, probably of a certain generation and older, would know him for is not what the younger generations know him for, because he gained a lot of popularity very recently when he appeared in a TV show.
He appeared in a TV show. German guy,
yeah,
so TV show.
Younger people might be like, oh, you're from that show, instead of what he's actually famous for.
What?
I'll give you the name of the TV show. The Mandalorian.
Werner Herzog.
Mandalorian.
Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog. So what's the school?
It's called...
I know what he's told. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
The Rogue Film School. It is called the Rogue Film School. And Werner Herzog very strongly believes that people are wasting time at 3-year-long film schools because there's nothing worth learning for 3 years in filmmaking. Whatever needs to be taught about filmmaking can be taught in the first 10 minutes or the first 1 hour. And after that, whatever time you're doing is to forge permits to shoot in places where you're not allowed to, or to pick locks to get into places where you're not allowed to go. And that's what he teaches in his course, apparently, in filmmaking.
nice question, yes.
So, Werner Herzog famously started off his film career by stealing a couple of cameras from the Munich Film School.
Yep.
So, I think the movie was Aguirre, the Wrath of God. To shoot that, he stole cameras from the Munich Film School and went to the Amazon and to shoot it, nearly killed his cast, but then made this fantastic movie, which is, become a cult favorite. I had a question, which I've asked like in 2-3 different quizzes, so I've stopped asking that question now, which was a connect question. I had put a picture of Leander Paes. I had put a picture of the Werner Herzog movie, The Wrath of God, and a picture of Eric Segal. And I would ask, what is the connect?
Leander Paes.
Eric Segal from, Love Story, the Doctors, The Class, famous
the
novelist.
The Class and all that, okay.
Yeah. Eric Segal, this movie, basically Aguirre, The Wrath of God, and Leander Paes. And the connect would be something very specific. It's very specific to them. Basically, I'm looking for a year and a place. That's the connect. I'm looking for a year and a place.
Well, the year and the place that comes to mind for Leander Paes is 1996, Atlanta. Does that have got anything to do with it?
Not that one.
No, I have no clue right now.
The Werner Herzog connect in that, Aguirre Wrath of God connects in two separate ways.
Yeah.
So it's a separate, so sometimes when I would put it up on the screen, I'd put that twice. And people would be like, why is there that twice? Because it connects it two separate ways, in two completely different ways, to the same combination of year and place. You're somewhat close to the right idea when you said 96 Atlanta.
Oh.
Somewhat close to the idea.
I have no clue at all, right?
Me neither. I don't know enough about the other two to make a reasonable connection.
Okay. When I mentioned 1996 Atlanta, what I was meant was you should be thinking, you were thinking of the Olympics when you said 96 Atlanta, right? Leander Paes' first Olympic goal, first Olympic medal. Think along the same lines, Olympics, and then think of what I've given you. I've given you Leander Paes, I've given you Eric Segal, and I've given you Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Okay, no.
Okay. So the connect was supposed to be 1972 Munich.
Ah, okay. Leander Paes' father won a gold medal in 1972 Munich.
Leander Paes was conceived in 1972 Munich.
Oh, conceived, is it?
Yes. So his mother was a volleyball player. Yeah, so he's actually said this in an interview. His mother was a volleyball player, right? Father was there for the Olympics. And what happened was when the attack from Black September, the Israeli athletes were killed, the Olympics was shut down for a few days. So during that time, his father and mother didn't have anything better to do, so they conceived him.
Okay, yeah, nice.
Eric Segal was very famously a commentator for the 1972 Olympics. So there's a very famous clip of him commentating for the marathon, or one of the long distance athletic races. And one of his students, he was a professor at the time, one of his students was nearing the final, and another person kind of tried to cut him off or cheat him, and he went on off this tirade during his commentary. So he was very famously a commentator for the 1972 Olympics. And Aguirre, the Wrath of God, was shot in 1972 using cameras stolen from the Munich Film School. Okay, that is the first way it connects. And the second way is that after Black September caused all of this and the Israeli athletes died, Mossad set in motion an operation to kill the Palestinian terrorists who were responsible for it. And that operation was called the Wrath of God.
Oh, yes, that is correct. Yeah, well, nice connect. Yeah.
Yeah. But I stopped asking it because hardly ever anybody ever gets the answer.
It's a tough one, but it's a good question. It's a great question.
Yeah, it's dependent. Question. It's a very indulgent, frankly. It's a very indulgent question because you have to know a few very specific pieces of trivia to kind of connect it. If you don't know even one, then you're screwed. So that's why I've stopped asking.
I will give you the name of the podcast, by the way, where I heard all of this information about Werner Herzog. It is a pop culture recommendation. People I mostly admire, which is by the Freakonomics author. He interviews people, and it's a lovely podcast. So Steve Levitt, who's a Freakonomics co-author, he interviews people. And he interviewed Werner Herzog in episode number 120, I believe. And it's called Werner Herzog Thinks His Films Are a Distraction. And it's a lovely podcast. You get to hear from one of the greatest filmmakers alive today. And he describes the entire journey, including stealing a camera to shoot his first film and about his film school and why lockpicking is important.
Nice. Okay, my question, right?
Yes.
Okay, possibly a slightly long one, so I guess you might have to listen carefully, but I think this is not a very tough, it's a very workable one. So, in 2006, a Canadian population health epidemiologist, doesn't matter, called Michael Kenock, was commissioned to design a methodology to measure something. Okay, so he was commissioned to measure something, so he created a survey that assesses 1,500 variables across 9 different dimensions or aspects. And the 9 dimensions are psychological well-being, time use, community vitality, culture, health, education, environmental diversity, living standard, and governance. This survey takes an average of 6 hours to administer to a respondent. And this project was rolled out in 2008 and is still kind of on. It's continually on. So, kind of two questions. Who were Kinnock's clients? So, who hired him to come up with this survey or methodology? And what was this survey trying to measure?
From the survey points that you mentioned, the first thing that came to my head, but I don't know how you could possibly get that from a survey, but were they trying to identify the measure or the things that lead to success?
Not exactly. Kind of thinking along the right lines, but this is a very specific measure, which is fairly well known around the world. It's only done in one place. That's kind of a big clue.
Done in only one place. So it's still done till date.
It is still done till date, yeah. So it was first kind of designed and set into motion in 2008. And so once the methodology was in place, it's still done to date. I guess they may be tweaking it every year or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, he's the man who put the kind of the framework of the whole program together to measure this certain thing.
Wow. I am so completely lost.
Yeah. Okay. Does it have anything to do with technology? Because 2008, I'm thinking social media, internet, I don't know.
No. Nothing to do with technology. I'm thinking of what kind of clue I could give. So what he was trying to measure is a fairly well-known thing. But the clue I would give is it's kind of an outlier or a different way of looking at things as opposed to the rest of the world. So we are talking about a specific country here.
Okay.
So I can tell you that basically Kinnock's clients were was a particular country.
It's a particular country?
Yeah, or the government of a country.
2008 makes you think of China also.
2008, the first thing that comes to mind is the economic collapse, the housing crisis.
I don't think the year is particularly relevant. It just started there. So okay. it wasn't triggered by anything that happened in 2008. This is the first time they tried to quantify or measure it. So I think what you need to think of, the nine different dimensions, which is psychological well-being, time use, community vitality, culture, health, education, environmental diversity, living standard and governance are all used, could all be different aspects of what?
This is not a happiness index or something, right?
That is thinking along the the right lines. Yes, correct. Kind of. Okay. Yes. I mean, you're almost there. What country would that be? You got the funda absolutely right. It's happiness. It's measuring happiness.
Okay, it's measuring happiness.
Which country?
Bhutan is the only country I know in relation to that happiness index.
That is correct. So it is Bhutan who, while the rest of the world has a measure called GDP, which is gross domestic product.
Huh?
Bhutan measures its thing in gross national happiness.
Oh, nice.
GNH. So they have a measure called gross national happiness. So they've always said happiness is more important to us than, you know, money and finance and economics and things like that. So only in 2008, they actually got somebody to measure it. So they actually have a measure called, and which they track, which is called gross national happiness.
Oh, okay.
You know, they could never get that done in India. Nobody would sit for a 6-hour survey in India.
That is also true. Yeah, that's true.
Truly, the definition of happiness is avoiding a 6-hour survey.
You would have to be very happy to be able to sit for a 6-hour survey. You'd be that happy and you'd be that good state of mind that somebody's like, I have a survey, but it'll take you 6 hours. No problem. Sit. We'll do.
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. That's the only question you need to ask on that survey. Will you sit for a 6-hour survey?
Okay. Yeah,
nice. But that's
nice question. Yeah. Great question. Okay. Let's move away from all these abstracts and go to someone specific. I want you to identify a person from his history that I'm about to give you. So X graduated from Cornell University in 1977. went on to work as an engineer for the Boeing Corporation and Sunstrand Data Control near Seattle. This, okay, Aditya already knows this, so retire to the pavilion, man. Okay, at Boeing, he invented a hydraulic resonance suppressor tube used on Boeing 747 airplanes. He applied
from sheer memory, can I complete your question? He applied to be a NASA astronaut 4 times.
Yes.
He quit Boeing to pursue a stand-up comedy career.
Yeah.
Because his friends thought he was really funny and he apparently looked like Steve Martin.
Yeah, he won a Steve Martin contest, a lookalike pro contest.
Yeah. Sorry, okay, that was just me flexing. Please continue. Please continue.
See how smug he looks. See, look at that smug face and tell me that he doesn't look more smug than me. Okay. So, now that you flexed for the sake of our audience and for poor Rajiv, let me just tell that question properly. Okay. So, at Boeing, he invented a hydraulic resonance suppressor tube that is used on Boeing 747 airplanes. He applied 4 times. Unsuccessfully for the NASA's astronaut training program. X started doing stand-up comedy after winning a Steve Martin lookalike contest in 1978. He began moonlighting as a comedian while working at Boeing. He quit his career at Boeing on October 3rd, 1986 to focus on his burgeoning comedy career. By the early 90s, his career on TV had exploded. The show that made him a household name in the 90s aired from 93 to 99, producing a total of 6 seasons and 100 episodes. The show starred X as a fictionalized version of himself. During its run, the show was nominated for 23 Emmy Awards, winning 19. So, who's X?
Oh, okay. Based on so many Emmys... The only thing I can think of is Kelsey Grammer or somebody like that.
Not Kelsey Grammer.
Also the Seattle connection.
No, the Seattle connection actually came after Boston. Kelsey Grammer originally showed up in Cheers.
Originated in Cheers,
which was in Boston. And then after he got divorced is technically when he shifted to Seattle and then became a radio host there.
Yeah. Okay, so not Kelsey Grammer. Obviously, 93 to 99.
Yes. Show starred X as a fictionalized version of himself.
Oh, okay. Is it Seinfeld then?
Of course. I knew you would say that. But no, it's not Seinfeld. No.
Okay.
That's a great guess though.
Okay. Do you have any other clues?
Okay. I have a very specific clue. So X was on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver. Okay, on May 12th, 2019. And he had a specific segment where he spoke about something. This should give you a clue about who he is and what he does and whatnot. Okay. This is a quote. So, I'm not using the F-bombs. This is all him. Here, I've got an experiment for you. Safety glasses on. By the end of this century, if emissions keep rising, the average temperature on Earth could go up another 4 to 8 degrees. What I'm saying is the planet's on fucking fire. There are a lot of things we could do to put it out. Are any of them free? No, of course not. Nothing's free, you idiots. Grow the fuck up. You're not children anymore. I didn't mind explaining photosynthesis to you when you were 12, but you're adults now and this is an actual crisis. Got it? Safety glasses off, motherfuckers.
That could be one of many people who would speak like that.
I would specifically, this is very uncharacteristic of him. He normally doesn't speak like this. So I would ask you to focus on this particular line. I didn't mind explaining photosynthesis to you when you were 12.
Okay. This is Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yes, this is Bill Nye, the science guy.
Yeah. Okay, correct. Now that I know the answer, all that that trivia is coming back to me. Yes.
Yes. And no nice props to Aditya for all that flexing because he was so smug about it. Your smugness cancels out the flex.
Fair. That is completely fair.
Okay. So that I think is all the time we have today for our regular questions. The episode went by in a flash. Aditya, what's your not-so-serious question for next week?
All right. So for next week's question, I want to know if instead of using the Darth Vader grotesque, if it was a Bollywood character, what would make an extremely iconic grotesque for a building? And you will find out in next week's episode.
We are so getting sued. Okay. So, guys, please tune in next week for the very last episode of Are You Quizzing Me? Because we are definitely going to get sued into oblivion. So, going back to the audience question at the beginning of today's episode, I hope some of you at least have figured it out. Prada's fall show of 2012 featured a diabolical collection of East German-inspired fashions. Many consider the show to be one of the greatest Prada has ever staged, with some very big names strutting down the catwalk wearing the Prada clothes. What was the theme and who were these big name models? Aditya and Rajiv, any guesses?
Hello.
The video of this particular show has gone viral again recently. Like, people have rediscovered it and they keep sharing it. So you'll find multiple shots of this on YouTube and Instagram going around.
2012? And you said something about East Germany. What is that?
Yeah, so the fashion was inspired by East Germany.
Okay. So, and I'm just taking a shot. Were the models on ex-East German athletes? You know, the ones that were very androgynous?
No. So basically, by the East German thing, they were looking to create a theme, and to reinforce that theme, they brought in specific people to model the clothes.
East Germany 2012.
Okay, forget the East Germany part. That was just to focus on the type of fashion which would give you a clue about the theme. I will give you the names of some of the people who walked the ramp that day. Okay? And you can then try and guess the theme. Gary Oldman, Willem Dafoe, Adrian Brody, Tim Roth.
Oh, these are something to do with villains.
Yes! So this was a villains-inspired fashion show. All the fashion was very East German, very dark, very villainy kind of clothes. And to model them, they brought in really famous villains. So donning the guise of villains, a number of A-list stars topped the show with a maniacal catwalk strut worth of the best 007 baddies. There are numerous videos online. You can see, I mean, like, Adrian Brody just looks like he's about to take over the world or something.
I think I've seen that. Yeah, it came up on my Instagram or sometime. Yeah.
Okay. So before we wind up, what's your any pop culture recommendations, Aditya, Rajiv?
I don't know about pop. I don't know how pop culture it is, but right now there's a book I'm reading, which is, I think it's a very well known book. So possibly everybody's read it, but it's not exactly. It's culture, not pop culture. And there's a book called The Early Indians by Tony Joseph. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have heard of it. It's on my reading list. I haven't gotten around to it yet.
I've recommended it in one of our episodes.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I back up Aditya's recommendation. It's a very, very interesting book, especially in light of all the debate in India currently about, you know, who is from where and who is what and things like that. And I think in a very anthropologic, it's obviously non-fiction.
Yeah.
And it's tracing anthropology through actually, and I'm particularly interested in books of this sort. So I've read a lot of books, and generally they go down the, the archaeological evidence route. But this one traces mostly language, which is a very interesting way of looking at it, I think. And so it traces connections of language between, it uses language to trace how people moved around the world and its specific references to India. So it's a great read, I think. And if anybody is interested in that sort of thing, I think you could check out the
fantastic.
And I especially love the analogy of a pizza that he uses to describe
genetic
makeup.
Don't spoil the book
for
him, Aditya. What are you doing?
I cannot actually remember that part.
You may not have reached it, Rajiv. He's spoiling the book for you. Shame. For no, shame, Aditya.
I'm pretty deep into it, but maybe I have at least.
I just want to mention again that this is ancient history. I don't think there are spoilers in ancient history.
Yeah, it's all already happened there.
But no, it's definitely worth a read. Thank you for re-recommending it, because it is definitely a phenomenal book and so useful in today's times to really remind us of how similar we are to each other, more than we are different.
That is,
I am going to recommend a TV show that we have probably talked about in the past, but I'm going to say it again, and I'm going to recommend a specific episode. This episode is called Free Churro, and it is from the TV show BoJack Horseman. We have recommended it in the past, but I recently rewatched Free Churro, and it is one of the best written TV episodes of all time, I generally think. And it is one of those episodes which would be considered a bottle episode if it was shot live action, because it's all set in one location. And in fact, it's just one person talking for a majority of the time. And I won't give any more spoilers. But if you have not watched BoJack Horseman, watch it and thank me when you reach the Free Churro episode, because it is beautiful, beautiful storytelling and honestly filmmaking. Yeah. So that is my recommendation for this week.
I'm going to give two recommendations this week. One is because Werner Herzog showed up in our quiz today, and there is a particular documentary of his which I recommend but with caution. So the name of the documentary is called The Grizzly Man. It is a very dark, very moody documentary. I would warn you not to watch it if you are easily affected by real life tragedies, especially the ones that end in very horrible, tragic ways. I don't want to spoil it, but if you are somebody like me who consumes all this kind of stuff regardless of how it will affect you, it is a great documentary to watch. It's a fantastic piece of filmmaking, and the ending is particularly haunting. It will stay with you for days. And I would say it hits you best if you did it, if you watched it like I did many years ago without knowing anything about it. Like, don't Google it, don't read up on it, just watch it and be prepared. It will change the way you look at documentaries for a long period of time. There are very few documentaries that leave you really haunted, and this is one of them. On a more lighter note, the second recommendation I have is a book series. It's called the Empyrean book series by a fledgling author by the name of Rebecca Yarros. I think it's a 7-part series, of which she's released 2 so far, and both of them have ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. They're pretty long books, but they're pretty satisfying. The first book is called Fourth Wing, and the second is called Iron Flame. And if you haven't guessed from the titles, they're both fantasy books. So think Harry Potter meets Game of Thrones, meets The Wheel of Time. So it is the characters are all mostly young adults, but it is very serious and very well written. And the world building is fantastic, and it's completely original. I usually don't go for recommending many fantasy books, but this one, I read it because it appeared on my Kindle and as a recommendation. So I just bought it and read it, and I just got hooked. You just cannot stop reading. The writing is just fantastic. So it's called the Empyrean series. Rebecca Yarros, the first one is Fourth Wing, and the second one is Iron Flame, and book 3 is expected next year. So another one, if you are still waiting for George R.R. Martin to release the next book from A Song of Ice and Fire, this should satiate you in the meantime. Lot of blood, lot of tragedy, a lot of gore is also there. So that's my recommendation, and that's it for this week. First, let me thank Mr. Rajiv De Silva. Rajiv, thank you so much. You've been a fantastic quiz master. Some really cracking questions over the past 2 episodes. And I hope, and I'm going to do this publicly so that we can blackmail you into doing this again, I hope we'll have you back on the show sometime.
Yes, actually, I would love to come back sometime. Assuming that you don't get like a crazy amount of negative reviews for these 2 episodes.
No, I guarantee you that's not going to happen.
We will wait and watch. But I've had a lot of fun on these episodes, so I definitely wouldn't strike it off my to-do list anytime soon. And thank you guys for having me. It's been good being part of this. I think the energy in which this is done is been great. It's been very infectious in a way. So I've had a lot of fun. So thanks for having me on. And let's see, sometime in the future, let's do one or a couple more sometime soon.
Yeah. You're going on our permanent returning guest list. I'm just telling you right now. Once you're in, you cannot back out. If you think you're out, we'll pull you back in.
Yeah.
I can assure you that everybody's going to love this episode, except, and I'll be honest here, people from Korea, who Vineet said are strange for some reason. Vineet just called them strange. And So if any of our Korean listeners are offended by that, honestly, it's Vinny's problem. The rest of us love you, okay? I love Korean people. I love Korean food. So take it up with Vinny. And also, you also mentioned in the previous episode that people from Indore are weird.
No, I said nobody would go to Indore. That was me.
Nobody's been to Indore. Okay, unless you're unusual.
Yeah.
So it is these specific niches that might be offended a little bit, but apart from that, I think they're okay. Right.
Well, it's 2024, so you'll always offend somebody no matter what you do. So
true. No, the way I keep offending somebody or the other in every episode, very soon I find that we'll not have any listeners anymore.
Oh, the number of times I've saved Vinith from being cancelled just by my editing tool.
But they're all factual truths. And I stand
by
that.
No, that is true. No, I'm kidding. I am absolutely kidding. The only things that I have to remove from episodes are my long pauses and silences while I ponder genius questions by Vinith. But in any case, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And as Vinith said, yes, we would not even love to. We would need you to come back because an episode like this is rare and we enjoyed ourselves more.
Yes, likewise.
It was just a fantastic experience here. So thank you.
Thank you too. Yes.
Thank you, our audience. That's all for this episode. Thank you for listening in. We hope you enjoyed the show. We hope you learned something new. If you liked what you heard, please consider subscribing to our podcast and leaving us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Take 2 seconds after I finish my spiel to go give us a 5-star rating, subscribe and hit the notification button on whichever platform you're listening to us on right now. It helps us reach a wider audience and allows more people to discover and enjoy the show. We'd also love to hear from you. Feedback, suggestions, even trivia. If you have any questions that you want asked on the episode, just send us an email at areyouquizzingme@gmail.com with the name of the quizmaster in the subject line. You can reach us on Instagram at areyouquizzingme. We also have a subreddit where you can be part of our Are You Quizzing Me community. You can post trivia, questions, especially visual questions, because it's a podcast medium, it's an audio medium. A lot of us can't ask any visual questions. So you can put visual questions on that and you can join the community at the subreddit Are You Quizzing Me. We appreciate your support and look forward to sharing more episodes with you in the future. Thank you guys for tuning in and have a great day.
See you guys next week.